This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Obviously, this is a conspiracy case. This is not that Lori Vallow is the one who pulled the trigger. It's that she was conspiring with her brother, Alex, who is now dead, to kill Charles Vallow. Are they going to have a difficult time proving this? Because you got to show why would Alex want to do her bidding? I know, you know, bidding, you know, motive, I know you don't have to prove, but it's kind of a big part of this in a conspiracy to show, okay, why would this guy... Why would he do it? Why would he go kill people for Lori? How are they going to establish that in the case like this?
And that's part of the challenge for the state in this case, mm-hmm. because they're not going to theoretically delve into all of the other parts of the story, because either they've chosen not to or because they were barred from doing it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, anybody who knows the story knows that Alex was her henchman. You know, I mean, he was the guy doing all the dirty work for Chad and Lori. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I think that there's a lot of people, including myself, that think that they had a hand in his untimely death from a pulmonary embolism. That I think that there's, if you do even a basic Google search, you can see that you can facilitate that. Mm-hmm. You know, by basically pumping air into somebody's, you know, it's essentially just getting an air bubble in there, and you can cause that to happen.
Yeah.
How they're going to be able to prove it up is going to be challenging without getting that side of the story in. Mm-hmm. It's going to boil down to these text messages between Lori and Alex. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why I was saying, that's why I think that they brought up the Nephi stuff. They're mm-hmm. going to explain what that meant, what mm-hmm. the significance of it is in these text messages. And that, you know, for them, it was kind of, you know, the lingo that they spoke and that was, you know, that was her giving directions, and that was her inquiring as to if things were done and, you know, was it finished, you know? And I mean, they're going to have to build it through circumstantial evidence that, you know, they stayed away from the house mm-hmm. for a very long period of time. They're at the Walgreens, and they're at the Burger King, and, you know, all those things. And you heard the strange chocolate milkshake testimony.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that the cop brought that up because of the amount of melting that had occurred with the shake, you know, because it was really hot out that day. So, you know, the cop was trying to say, well, according to the milkshake, you know, they had been out there for a minute, or, you know, they had just gotten back from Burger King because it was still pretty much frozen, you know. So it's got different challenges in the first case, that's for certain.
Well, and some of it just shows how ridiculous the story is without, it's like, show me how ridiculous this is without showing me how ridiculous this is. You find out that your husband is dead or murdered, and you take the kids to Burger King. I mean, it's just like, I mean, I wouldn't even be taking them to school. You know, it'd be like, let's go to my friend's house today. I have to go deal with this, and then I'll come get you, and we can talk about this when we need to. It's like, take him to Burger King, take him to school, just like it's an ordinary day. And she backs it up in the opening statements of, I took them because he promised that he would take them. So I had, you know, basically had to fulfill that Burger King promise.
When you see the interview there,
yeah,
like with the cop and her, and she, like, it just is not a woman who has any compassion.
It's
like, if you were watching that, not knowing what happened, what preceded it, you would have no idea that anybody that she knew.
You think she was like the neighbor,
right? Like, and purportedly cared about at some point in her life. And she had to have cared about, they were together for a long time. Mm-hmm. You would assume that there was some point in time that she had feelings for him. And you just saw no indication of it, you know, at all in that interview. And I'm talking about when they're standing outside of the house mm-hmm. and you see Ty Lee over there, just kind of standing there, and they're asking her questions, and she's just, you know, chuckling and just talking about, like, it's the weirdest thing. And it just really goes to her mindset. Like, I think that's very powerful evidence in terms of the jury's going to be looking at it like, what is going on with this woman? You know, like, that is just not a normal human response for a situation like that to have occurred, you know, an hour prior. Yeah. You know, it's like all those little things. It's going to be putting together all these little pieces in the circumstantial case again, like most cases, wherein you're going to have to be able to create this picture for the jury where there's going to be holes. But when they step back and they look at the totality of the circumstances and they see the picture of the puzzle that the state's put together, even with those little holes in the story, that you still see what the full picture is. And, you know, I think they'll be able to get there. But, you know, obviously I'm curious to see what they're going to do to be able to get that conspiracy charge like nailed, because you do have to show agreement. You know, I mean, you have to meet each and every element. It's like I was telling Allie, because we had covered the first trial in depth.
Yeah.
And, you know, in that case, like I had always felt, I'm like, this is one of those cases where this woman's gallivanting around in Hawaii when her kids are allegedly missing and doesn't seem to have a care in the world, is out buying wedding rings, is doing all the things that she did. And I just thought that the backstory of that was going to lead the jury to the conclusion that this woman had a hand in it without them having to meet each and every element, which is required by law. Mm-hmm. But this is one of those cases where I just didn't think that they were going to need to do it, because the jury's going to be like, I don't care that they met each and every element. No woman that didn't have a hand in it would have been acting like that.
Sure.
Like no parent would be doing that. So, you know, she's going down. Here it's a little bit of a different circumstance, because again, you're not getting into all of the Ty Lee and JJ story, you know, not to the extent that they did the first time. This is a like kind of an isolated incident and, you know, and it predates all the other stuff. And like, they're going to have to just sell the concept of she wanted to be with Chad and she wanted that money. You know, and those two things were the driving motivation for her. And, you know, they'll be able to bring in that her and Chad were married very soon after, you know, and without her getting on the stand to put up some kind of defense and give her version of the story, I don't know how she's going to rebut it.
I don't know how she would rebut it either. I mean, especially, I mean, we clearly know the state is going to bring in the whole Nephi thing and the whole wacky belief system there that they thought, you know, he was possessed by Ned. I always want to say Ned Ryerson, and I know it's not. Ned? Ned Ryerson? Yeah. Boom!
He's a very religious guy.
Yeah, I know it's not Ned Ryerson from Groundhog's Day, but...
Or Ned Flanders.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, or Ned Flanders.
Yeah.
Why they pick Ned, I don't know. It just what came to their mind. But they're going to... I mean, this is all going to be out there. This is all going to be presented, and I wonder how triggering it will be to her when this stuff is presented on how she's going to handle anything on cross for anybody. And what, you know, what is she going to do? What is she going to say? Is she going to go down that road of treating her belief system as if it is fact and everyone else in the room is crazy? That I think will be a very telling point when these sort of things get out and we get out of just the CPR area of the testimony that we're hearing about with Charles being on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, that's the testimony that makes this thing worth watching.
Yeah.
It's like, see, when we get to that kind of aspect of the case, how she's going to handle it. Like, is she going to go full nuts? You know, I mean, it's like, you know, we've heard her. We've heard her, you know. I mean, her theory is that we're all wrong and she's right. She's got it from up on high that, you know, everything that she thinks is the way that it's going to go down, and we're the ones who are nuts, and you know that we should believe her. So I mean, is she going to put that on display? I mean, she's got to realize that we do think that she's all nuts, and the jury is going to think she's nuts as well. So whether or not she believes in her heart of hearts and in her diseased mind that we are the crazy ones, that we're the ones who are just out of the loop because we don't believe her, is she smart enough to realize that that's not going to be an effective way to get a not guilty in this case? Because insulting the jury is the first way to get yourself convicted in a case. So it's going to be interesting.
She obviously has her own list of witnesses that she plans on calling, at least some of them. How is there any way, shape or form that you see any of these people helping her? Or is it just going to be more folks that are going to end up sinking her on cross from the prosecution?
I, anybody that was a part of the story, I can't see any of them helping her. You know, if you've got like an expert or two, which I think that she does, obviously that she's going to have to lean into those folks.
Yeah.
She, again, you know, this is the challenge of going pro se. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that old axiom, you know, the lawyer who represents themselves as a fool for a client, you know, and she is the lawyer mm-hmm. in this situation. And, you know, and you're too close to the situation to be able to look at things objectively. That's why you have other people represent you. You have to be able to take a step back and say, okay, well, this isn't going to work because of X, Y, and Z. And I don't think that she's going to be capable of doing that. Mm-hmm. I think that she thinks that she's going to be able to, you know, kind of manipulate her way to whatever she needs people to say on the stand. And it's just not going to work out in her favor. But I mean, we'll see. Like, I mean, like she needs to have a very, very slim case.
Yeah.
Like she's like, if she thinks she's going to parade a bunch of people up there, they're going to be in any way, helpful to her. I think that she's in for a rude awakening.
Yeah. Less is more with her. I would think at the end of the day, when the jury does get this, let's say that she never does testify. We never end up hearing anything about Tylee or JJ or her past criminal acts. And they're discussing this. Let's say some of the jurors do know about the past a bit. Are they allowed to discuss any of that in the jury room at the end of like, well, I do know this about this, or do they have to completely keep it strictly to the evidence that was presented in this case, whether they have any knowledge of anything in the past or not, to enlighten maybe those who don't?
Yeah, no, they have to stick to the facts and evidence that were presented. You can't mm-hmm. bring in anything else that wasn't part of the case in chief of either side. You can't do it.
Yeah.
So, you know, but again, what you can and can't do.
They're humans.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like,
that's what I'm wondering though. Like if it does get brought up somehow, somebody's discussing, they're like, well, she also killed her kids. What, you know, is there any safeguards to prevent that from happening in the conversation in the jury room? Is there anybody there that's a third party that can be like, whoa, this is not part of the case. We can't be doing hearsay of what you heard, or does this just, I don't know how that works technically.
Yeah, technically, no, there is no safeguard. There is no, like when they're back there alone. There's nobody back there with them. And there is, if somebody brings it up and you've got, you know, you can't unring a bell situation happens back there. It happens.
Could that be looked at as prejudicial? Like if later after everything is done and if she tries to do an appeal on this, I don't know if she will, but because it's her. But let's say that we found out that somebody did bring this up in jury when they're deliberating. Could that be looked at as, wait a second, this should not have happened. They brought this up. They weren't supposed to. That constitutes this wasn't a fair trial because a juror introduced prejudicial information to other jurors in the jury room.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
it could definitely, you know, the question is, how is she finding that out? You know, because like none of the jurors are going to be chatting with her.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody speaks out in an interview later, something like that, where like, yeah, then they talked about this, because inevitably some of these folks are going to talk and they're going to share their experience and write a book or whatever. So, I mean, if that comes out that happened, there's just, it seems like a very open and shut case, but it seems like there's a lot of pitfalls here that people could fall in as well, just to play by the rules. So we don't have that sort of issue. But again, people are human that, you don't sometimes even know where the pits are.
Well, you hope that there's at least one juror back there that's like a rule follower.
Yeah. Yeah.
Say, whoa.
Yeah.
Well, you can't bring that up. We can't consider that at all.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that cures the issue, you know, and that ultimately the juror is going to have to say, well, yeah, you know,
yeah.
I mean, but it was brought up, but it didn't play into why we convicted her. You know, I mean, like that's ultimately what it's going to have to boil down to. If somebody let slip that came out in deliberations, you know, that her sordid background makes its way into the deliberation room and people learn of things that they didn't learn through the trial, it's going to, you know, it would get dealt with. I don't think that it would ever succeed in any way, shape or form, especially, you know, if you've got a juror who's going to say, all right, look, we can't consider that because they get an instruction on it. I mean, the safeguard is that, they get a jury instruction on it that you're not to consider anything that wasn't brought up in trial in terms of the facts and the evidence that was presented to you. You can't bring up anything that people may know from outside sources. It's not a part of this equation.
Yeah.
And if, as long as you've got a juror or two or more back there, they're like, we can't consider that. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I get it. I hear what you're saying, but that has nothing to do with this case. I think it'll be fine.
It will be interesting.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.